Very good to be here with you this evening. We are getting into our survey of the Gospels, actually a survey of the Gospels in Acts. We will be going through the five books over the course of this series, and I have study questions to pass out to you at the end of the Bible study. What we're going to do is to go through the Gospels in a harmonized account, so that we will, in a sense, be studying all four of the Gospels simultaneously, as we will go through sort of step by step and put the story together. But before we start into that, I think it is good to sort of step back and look at the four Gospels individually, and also to look at the way in which the world was prepared for the introduction of the Messiah and his message. The Scripture speaks in the book of Galatians. Paul says, talks about God's own Son, whom he brought forth in the fullness of time. The time was right. And that is a crucial thing, as we understand that, to realize the way in which things were done. One of the things that was fundamental to preparing the way for the gospel, the preaching of the gospel, and the establishment of the church, was the dispersion of the Jews all over the known world. Now, this played a bigger role than a lot of people realize, and it set the stage for the fact when the gospel went to the Gentiles. Because in virtually every area, all over the Gentile world, the Jews had been scattered. The dispersion started at the time of the Babylonian conquest, when many Jews were taken captive to the east. But later on, during the time of Persian rule, and particularly during the time of Greek rule, the Jews were dispersed throughout the area of those empires. And then during the time of the Roman Empire, there had come increasingly large settlements of Jews in Rome and elsewhere in the Roman Empire. Now, most of the area that we read of in the New Testament, most of the churches that we read of being established in the book of Acts, are in the eastern half of the Roman Empire. With the exception of Rome, virtually everything else you read of is in the area from Greece east. The area of modern Greece, the area of modern Turkey, scattering across through those eastern areas. There was a very heavy concentration of Jews. Indications in terms of the historical studies on the Roman Empire indicate that about 10% of the population of the Roman Empire, about 10% of the population of the Roman Empire was Jewish. Most of those were in the eastern part of the empire, though there were Jews scattered throughout. There were Jews in North Africa and Jews in Jews in Italy and various places, but probably two-thirds of them were in the eastern half of the empire. The population of the Roman Empire at the time of the first century is figured to be about 100 million, and the Jewish population was about 10 million. Now, one of the things that shows is that the Jews had a considerable influence throughout the Roman world. One of the things that had occurred during that time was the adoption of the weekly calendar that was based on the Jewish pattern. Now, the Babylonians had a calendar that was based on a 7-day week, but it was not the cycle. Let's say the numbering of days was not the same, and it was the Jews in virtually every city where there was any significant presence of Jews, there was a synagogue. Now, there's an interesting phrase that we read, that we come across in the book of Acts, that for a long time was just sort of read and nobody really gave a whole lot of thought to what it meant. You find it, for instance, when Paul, in one of the synagogues, we'll just maybe just pick out a spot and let me show you. Here we find back in here in the book of Acts that this expression that was used when Paul would address there in the synagogue when he said, "You men of Israel, and you that fear God." Now, this this expression that we find referenced here in the book of Acts, where Paul began to you read over and over as to how he persuaded, he reasoned in the synagogues, and how he went into these places. Well, this the expression that I wanted to call your attention to was the expression "you that fear God," and the expression, you know, people have tended to simply read over that and to not necessarily understand exactly what you know, what was involved. The expression of the term "the God-fearers" has turned out, various inscriptions and various things have been come up with that have chapter 13 over here is one of the places where you will read it. This is where Paul had come here to Antioch in Pisidia, and when he stood up in Acts 13:16, he beckoned with his hand and said, "Men of Israel, and you that fear God, give audience." Now, this expression, "you that fear God," the God-fearers among the Gentiles were Gentiles that were not circumcised, but they attended the synagogue service. Now, they kept the Sabbath. They, you know, kept clean and unclean meats. They did certain of these things. They attended synagogue every Sabbath. They heard the reading of the law. They were not full converts to Judaism in the sense that they had not become circumcised and therefore were excluded from taking part in the temple rituals. But they were free to attend the synagogue. And there was a considerable group of people throughout the Roman Empire, a large contingent of Gentiles, that had a considerable exposure to the Jewish community, to the Scriptures. Now, one of the things that tells us is that when Paul went in to these Gentile areas, and there were Gentiles who were baptized, the overwhelming majority of them in the first decades of the New Testament church were God-fearers. They were individuals who were already acquainted with the law of God. They had been attending synagogue. They had been hearing the Scriptures read, and that's where they came in contact with Paul's message. That is one of the things that is one of the, this dispersion of the Jews. You see, God was preparing the way for the growth of the gospel and the church. Because now you have a nucleus, even in the Gentile areas, even among the Gentiles, of people who were familiar with the law of God. That's one of the reasons that you don't find a lot of space or focus which day is the Sabbath or something of that sort, because it wasn't a question. It wasn't an issue. The Jews had no question as to which day the Sabbath was. And the Gentiles, who were early converts, I had been accustomed to going to the synagogue every Sabbath. They were God-fearers. They were familiar with the law. The issue that you find keep coming up in the New Testament had to do with the issue of circumcision, because you could not, these God-fearers could not be fully accepted as a part of the Jewish community without undergoing circumcision. Now, as the Christian community was growing, then the issue came up, well, could they be accepted, could they be fully a part of the Christian community without undergoing circumcision? Because, you know, it wasn't an issue for the first converts because they were all Jews, so they were all circumcised, so the issue didn't come up one way or the other. But once some of these Gentiles, the overwhelming majority of whom were God-fearers. It's interesting that even some of the Roman poets, Juvenal, who was one of the famous Roman poets, makes sarcastic reference in some of his poetry to Romans in Rome who were resting on the seventh, on the Sabbath, who were abstaining from pork, and who were worshiping the God in the clouds. That was his expression. Sort of an interesting quote, because what it shows, he's not in the context, he's not referring to Jews. He's talking about Romans. He's talking about Gentile Romans, Roman citizens in Rome, who were abandoning, as he looked upon it, the faith of their fathers, the old Roman traditions, and were accepting, were attending the synagogue, and were accepting many of what were considered Jewish customs. Many of these things simply didn't become issues until later on, and until the backlash of anti-Jewish sentiment that occurred in the aftermath of the Jewish revolt and the Romans cracking down on the Jews, and then particularly after the second Jewish revolt in 135, there was a very pronounced movement to distance the so-called Christian church, which by that time was primarily moving away from being Christian. But anyway, God prepared the way by this dispersion of the Jews and ensuring, you know, the Bible itself. In this country, anybody who wants a Bible can get one. You can get one free, you know. There are Bibles around. You can get an expensive one. You can also get a cheap one. Anybody who wants one, it's accessible to them. But in those days, there was no printing press. If you got a Bible, you got one that was hand-copied. That would make, you know, if you had to pay somebody's salary to sit down and copy this thing out for you, it would be an expensive proposition. Wouldn't many folks have a Bible? But what you had in each of the areas where there was a Jewish synagogue, you know, the first thing they did before they built a building was they... the first thing they bought was a Torah. So it ensured that there was access to the Scriptures in every place where there was any congregation of Jews. So when we're told that the Bereans searched the Scriptures daily to see whether those things were so, sometimes we have the idea, you know, the Bereans sort of sitting down every morning with their early in the morning with their Bible and their cup of coffee, and they were searching the Scriptures. Well, they searched the Scriptures, but they weren't doing it that way. They, for the most part, individuals would maybe have portions of certain Bible books. Someone may have a copy of this book, someone else may have a copy of that book, but for the most part, they had to go to the synagogue. And of course, there were a whole variety of scrolls, and they had to look at it in that way. But the fact that there was a dispersion of the Jewish community ensured that there were copies of the Scripture that were available almost everywhere. And that was something that had not been the case even as recently as 100 years before the birth of Christ. So that was a very significant thing. You see, the Jews, wherever they went, they carried copies of the Scriptures. And they carried a knowledge of the way of God. So there was a familiarity in the pagan world with, quote, Jewish customs. Many Gentiles had been exposed to information from the Bible. That was one of the key things that had happened that prepared the way for the growth of the gospel. Secondly, the Greek language had become virtually a universal language due to Alexander's conquests. Because of the Greek emphasis on education, literacy had reached a high point in the ancient world. Sometimes we don't realize how much of an ebb and flow history has had. People look back and they compare literacy, for instance, in this country now with back in the 1800s or the 1700s or with the Middle Ages, and they say, well, you know, when times passed, hardly anybody could read, and now just about everybody can read. Well, the reality is there has been ebb and flow in some of that. There have been times and cultures when, among the Jewish community, the overwhelming majority of people could read and write. That has always been the case. The overwhelming majority of the Jewish community in Palestine could read and write. That was it was considered a duty to be able to read the Torah, and that's why the idea was that any Jewish man ought to be able to be called upon in the synagogue to be able to stand up and to read from the Torah. So. But the Greeks placed great emphasis on education as well. And frankly, the majority of people, particularly in the urban areas, not so much in the rural areas, but certainly the majority of people in the urban areas were able to read and write. And literacy was at a higher point at the time of the first century than for most of the centuries since. Also was important because it meant that people were able to search the Scriptures and they were able to access some of that information. Thirdly, the relative peace and stability which the Roman Empire provided, along with the system of Roman roads which facilitated travel, that opened the way for the proclamation of the gospel over a wide area. You realize that the all of Western Europe was tied together, along with much of the Middle East and North Africa, was all tied together as a part of the Roman world. The Mediterranean Sea was a Roman lake. Even as far afield as the British Isles, the center of course, Britain was a part of the Roman Empire, or at least England was. The Hadrian's Wall there at the border between Scotland and England was sort of the line of demarcation, but the center, for instance, for tin mines. Tin is an important commodity, and certainly was an important commodity in ancient times in the making of bronze. The primary source of tin for the entire Roman Empire came from Cornwall, there off of the southwestern coast of the southwestern corner sort of Britain. There was, of course, regular commerce back and forth, ships sailing there back and forth. It's interesting when you study over that. You find that as you go to that area of Cornwall and particularly the area of Glastonbury, which is a small town now, but it has a very ancient history, you go there and you find that they have many traditions about, for instance, that Joseph of Arimathea was, you know, had frequently visited there, and according to the tradition, he was a merchant, was a tin merchant, and we certainly know that there were that the tin trade was there. We know there was a lot of commercial traffic. Britain was an integral part of the empire. You had back then, just like you had now, you know, some of the Jews had were very involved in certain commercial ventures and sort of had cornered the market on certain things. So the point is that you had an influence that was spread all over. The fact that this was all a part of the Roman Empire meant that there was relative peace. You could travel fairly safely, and all over the the Romans maintained security, and they maintained they built excellent roads, the best roads that had been built prior to the 20th century. In some ways, better. It's interesting if you go and look as to how deep they dug down to build Roman roads. I mean, it's you know, they built them to last, and there's some of them that still are. It's remarkable. But the result of that, they had regular post locations where they could move the Roman mail, by changing horses at these regular post stops about every 20 miles on some of the major roads, you know, it was possible for one of the Roman emperors to actually travel several hundred miles, over 300 miles in a day's time, because they were, you know, he was in his carriage and they were switching out drivers and switching out horses every 20 miles. I don't know how often they switched out the drivers, but they were able to make incredible time because the roads were good. A whole lot better than anything you had. You'd probably have to come to, you know, sort of World War II and beyond in this country, because we had dirt roads all over the place. You don't have to go back that far. A lot of dirt and gravel roads here in Texas. So the point was, now, that you had regular Roman mail routes. You had, you know, carriages and horses and wagons that moved that way. The point was that it made possible safe and relatively rapid transit over much of the areas of the Roman Empire. Certainly far better than anything before that and than anything has been for centuries afterward. Another factor that prepared the way in terms of or the world for the reception of the gospel was that pagan mythology had really ceased to be believed by virtually by most of the educated people. You know, if you go back and you read pagan myths, nothing particularly edifying about it, you know. In fact, it's sort of like a soap opera. It was the original soap opera on some of that. Now, the philosophers and the mystery religions, the philosophers came along and tried to interpret these pagan myths as being allegory and representing, tales of conflict between reason and emotion and reason and passion, or between wisdom and foolishness. And they would try to interpret it that way. The mystery religions had come along from the East and had gained some inroads, but the people had ceased to be satisfied with the traditional religion of the Greek and the Romans. The Greeks and the Romans. It was something that really didn't offer satisfying answers to life's questions. Most people who had very much education just simply were dissatisfied with it. They knew that really did not satisfy. Well, when you have a vacuum created, when you have a people have a sense of the recognition that there's something that they're in need of. You know, transition times are times of instability. They're times when people are searching for things. And so the timing in terms of the ancient world, it was a time when education was increasing, when there was a wide dispersion of the Jews, when there was better communication and travel than at virtually any other time period in terms of ancient history. All of these things were factors, and you add to that that many people were searching. They were looking. So there was a certain receptivity that was had. That's why so many of them were visiting the synagogues. And they may not have accepted everything they heard, but they were there to listen. They found things that made much more sense than anything else. Among the Jewish world, there was something else. One other area, because at least of a limited understanding of Daniel's 70-week prophecy given back in Daniel 9, many of the Jewish religious leaders were expecting the Messiah in their day. And it was a time of expectation. There was a lot of frustration because of Roman domination, and the Jews were restive because of their subservient status to the Romans. They were eagerly anticipating the coming of the Messiah who would throw off the Roman yoke and reestablish the kingdom. This was something that was in the public mind. And there were, of course, a variety of false messiahs who didn't come to anything but were running around and trying to do that. You read of even one of Christ's disciples called Simon the Zealot. The term zealot referred to these Jewish freedom fighters, this political faction that was seeking to overthrow the Roman government. That was sort of the militia movement of the day. You know, these were the sort of the Republic of Texas crowd, this was the mindset. It's interesting, you know, Christ drew apostles, he drew disciples from a wide variety of backgrounds. Simon the Zealot came out of that sort of background. Matthew the publican came out of exactly the opposite faction, you know. He was a collaborator with the Romans, as these people would have looked upon it. It's interesting how God brings people out of a variety of backgrounds and blends them together. As a family, we have people who come out of a variety of let's look at it this way, that if it weren't for the church and the truth that we have in common, most of us would A, never have known each other, and B, maybe wouldn't have liked one another if we did. we would have had different political ideas and different been from different areas of the country or the world, and had different perspectives on things. And Christ called people from a variety of circumstances, and the majority that he called were, let's say, from the average a midsection of the Jewish community, but he called, later on, Paul became one of the most prominent of the apostles. Paul came from a background of someone who had a lot of formal education and religious training. He was very schooled in religiously. Nicodemus, who was clearly one who was that way. He and Joseph of Arimathea both evidently served on the served in the Sanhedrin. Both had quite a background and experience in that way. Many of those others, like Peter, James, John, and Andrew, you know, some of those came from, let's say, a background as small businessmen. They operated their fishing fleet there with their father. So you had people who came from a variety of circumstances. But they were blended together by being part of something far bigger than any of them. Now, as we look at the four Gospels, it is... Let's look a little bit at the question of why are there four? Each of these Gospels tells the story of the Gospel that Jesus Christ brought from a little different perspective. God has chosen down through time to work through human beings. And he has called people of different backgrounds, of different temperaments, of different with different strengths and weaknesses. God does not simply make a zombie out of someone. He works through that individual. And the work of God at any given time, and you can start in the Old Testament and come on through the New, to some extent, always reflects a little bit of the personality of the individuals through whom God has chosen to work at any given time. I mean, you go back, King David. God called him, and he used him. David was used by God to write most of the Psalms. Now, he was a man that had, was a very emotional and expressive individual. He was poetic. He was musical. Among his other abilities. Well, that lent itself to someone who was able to take some of the deepest thoughts and yearnings and feelings of human beings and be able to put them in words and express them and write them down where they could be preserved. And no telling at the millions of people who have turned to the Psalms over the years and found comfort, found something that just... sort of how they usually don't have to go too far before you find something you can connect with in the Psalms. Well, God chose a man who had the ability and the proclivity to be able to do certain of those things, and he used him to do that. Now, with the writers of the four Gospels, it enables us to look at Jesus Christ and his ministry through four sets of eyes. And each one tended to focus on different things. Now, the story coincides, and the Gospels don't contradict one another. You know, many of the scholars, they try to sit down and come up with all sorts of theories. A lot of them think, well, Mark is the shortest, and so they think, well, maybe Mark was written, and then the writers of Matthew and Luke sort of copied from him, and they added in a few things, but they sort of copied from him. Well, the truth of the thing is that Matthew, Mark, and Luke tell the story from a similar perspective. In other words, they start at the beginning and they tell it on through. Well, obviously, if you're telling, if several people write a biography of the same individual, there's going to be a lot of similarity, because if you're getting your facts straight, there's got to be a lot of similarity. But what you will find is that different authors concentrate on different things. Now, partly it was the audience to which they were writing. Matthew is most likely the first of the Gospels written. It is written from a Jewish perspective. Matthew was an educated Jew. He was a Roman civil servant, a tax collector. So he certainly would have been an educated man who could have spoken and written Greek, which was the sort of, particularly of the Eastern Roman Empire, was the common language. And Greek was commonly used in the Western Roman Empire as well. Paul wrote his epistle to the Romans in Greek. All the educated Romans on up through about the 2nd on into the 3rd century could speak Greek. Greek began to fall into disfavor and began to be neglected in the West after somewhere perhaps during the 3rd century. And on during the Middle Ages. It got to where virtually no one in the West could knew much Greek, but that was not the case in the first and second centuries. Matthew's gospel we would date to somewhere around 45-50 A.D. According to ancient tradition, it was written initially in Hebrew or Aramaic. We don't have copies that way that have come down to us. Our copies are in Greek. I don't see any reason to discount the tradition that it was written in Hebrew, or more likely Aramaic, which is a dialect. But very likely was translated by Matthew himself into Greek, and it's the Greek version that has been preserved, because the scripture has been preserved, the New Testament scriptures, primarily in the Greek-speaking world. Matthew is in many ways the Jewish gospel. It concentrates on the king and the kingdom. The term kingdom of heaven is the term normally used in the gospel of Matthew, and that is, it's used 33 times. That was the common term in use among the Jews. They were very sensitive about the idea of misusing or taking in vain the name of God, and so they often avoided that and would use some euphemism or some other term. And so they normally, among the Jews, they referred to the kingdom of heaven, which has given rise to certain misunderstanding in English, because there are people who think the kingdom of heaven is in heaven. Well, it didn't say the kingdom in heaven, it said the kingdom of heaven. The kingdom of heaven is the kingdom ruled by heaven or from heaven. Jesus is introduced in the Gospel of Matthew as the son of David. And there is an emphasis in the genealogy. You see, Matthew opens up in Matthew 1:1, the book of the generation of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Matthew immediately connects Jesus Christ as being the seed of David and the seed of Abraham. Well, any Jew in reading this was certainly be conscious of the fact of the promises, that the promises had been made to Abraham. See, Matthew didn't trace it back any further than Abraham. He didn't go back to Abraham's genealogy or to Noah or to Adam. Didn't need to. The promises were made to Abraham. So you start with Abraham, and he emphasized Abraham, David, and Jesus Christ, because the promises were made to Abraham that in his seed all nations would be blessed. The promise was made to David that his, the Messiah would come from his lineage, his throne would last on into eternity. And so what Matthew does is to emphasize that Jesus the Messiah, was the son of David and was the son of Abraham. Then he begins with Abraham and brings the genealogy on down, the legal genealogy that brings it on down through Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom was born Jesus. So Christ was the legal heir through Joseph to these promises. And he emphasizes that. Matthew quotes the Old Testament 65 times. It has more Old Testament quotes than any of the other gospel accounts. So he alludes to the Old Testament extensively. The words righteous and righteousness are used more often in Matthew than in the other three gospels combined. It is an emphasis that Matthew strikes. Matthew ties in with the Old Testament because it was written to people who were deeply familiar with the Old Testament scriptures, and so it connects in with those in a special way. The Sermon on the Mount is given in its greatest detail in the book of Matthew. Well, the point of this is Christ came as the lawgiver. You know, Moses had prophesied in Deuteronomy 18 that the Lord God would raise up a prophet like unto me, he said, Deuteronomy 18:15. The Lord your God will raise up unto you a prophet like unto me. Well, what was unique about Moses? Moses was the only one through whom God revealed law. All of the other prophets, all of the ones who came after Moses, referred back to the law. But none had the authority to override what had been said. Jesus, in the Sermon on the Mount, one of the statements that he makes several times, it has been said unto you of old time, you shall not commit adultery. But I say unto you, whosoever looks on a woman to lust after her in his heart has committed adultery already. Well, what you find is that Christ quoted the Old Testament. He was quoting a statement from Moses, not just the Old Testament. He's quoting from Moses. In each of those statements, it's been said unto you of old time. And then he exercised the authority to say, I'm modifying what was said. And what he did was he amplified it. He explained the spirit of the law. But Christ possessed the authority to go beyond, to clarify, to supersede something that Moses was said. Moses had said, you know, the Pharisees got upset. They tried to trip him up on this question of divorce and remarriage. And Christ answered them, and the answer he gave them they didn't like. He said, and they immediately got defensive. And they said, Moses commanded us to give a writing of divorcement. And Jesus corrected them, and he said, now Moses permitted you to do that for the hardness of the heart. But from the beginning, it was not so. And he began to go through. He gave a teaching that was far more binding than anything that had been understood previously. The point was, Jesus Christ came in the role of lawgiver. He built upon, he went beyond, he magnified the law as it was prophesied in the Old Testament that he would do. Matthew is the only one of the Gospels that tells of the Jews' request that Christ's blood be upon them. You know, the statement that they made to Pilate, let his blood be on us and on our children. Only one of the Gospels you'll read it in is Matthew. The sealing of the stone when Christ was buried. The story of how the stone was sealed. The setting of the guard. The fabrication of the story that the disciples came and stole the body. The rising up of many of the saints after Christ's resurrection. You know, these are incidents that aren't mentioned in any of the other Gospels. Now, they would have been of special interest to Matthew's readers because Matthew was writing to people primarily, I mean, the initial audience for Matthew's gospel was there in Palestine. It was Jewish Christians. Well, among the population there, there were a lot of people that had heard the story. The time Matthew wrote, the crucifixion probably wasn't was no more than about 15 years in the background. You know, 15 years ago isn't that long. Mr. Armstrong died 14 years ago. So when you start thinking in that terms, you know that telling a story, people have heard different details and different things. Matthew focused in on things that would have been known in the area. You know, the story of the sealing of the fact that the disciples came and stole the body, well, that was a story that was widespread in Judea. Because after all, the Pharisees paid the guards to tell the story. And Matthew gave details that people could go back and corroborate, that they would tie in, would add explanation to things that they had heard. He focused in on some of these things and gave that. Now, part of Matthew is written in a chronological fashion and part of it is topical. The first four chapters of Matthew seem to be chronological. And then chapters 5 through 13 are topical. By topical, what Matthew did was he went through and he would give different incidents in Christ's life. He focused in on what Christ taught in a variety of circumstances, but his focus was more on what Christ taught on the subject rather than what Christ taught at just one specific time. You know, Christ traveled throughout Judea and Galilee and Samaria and surrounding areas for 3.5 years. He traveled up and down. He talked to crowds over and over and over, scattered through towns and villages. Obviously, over the course of that time, day in and day out, he repeated many of the same themes many times. But he didn't always do it verbatim. You know, he would add in more details one time. He would emphasize one thing. Another time he would emphasize something else. You know, my wife can tell you, she got to listen. That's the right way of saying it. She did listen to the same sermon 3 different times on the Sabbath in Oklahoma City, here in Dallas, and in Gladewater. One of the things she, I'm sure, would tell you is, and some of the commentators in comparing what Matthew and Mark and Luke say, for instance, with the Sermon on the Mount, they point out, you know, differences. Well, the point is, Matthew gives the most, he treats much of his material in the center part of his book. He treats by topic. And so he puts together what Christ said on the same subject, though he may have said it, may be gleaned from what he said in a variety of different places. Matthew tends to be topical in that way. That's why we so often go to Matthew's account for what Christ said or did, because what Christ said on subjects, we generally go there for the Sermon on the Mount and for other things, because Matthew tended to be more topical and to bring things in that were on the same subject, though it may have been said at different times. The latter part of Matthew tends to be more chronological, chapters 14 on through 28. So Matthew plays an important role is in terms of the gospel accounts. It focuses in on Christ being born as the son of David. And that emphasis, you know, it starts out Matthew 1:1, the book of the generation of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Matthew 2:1, when Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea. Again, tying in, you see, Bethlehem was the city of David. And goes through and focuses on some of that. Matthew is the one who tells of the rulers coming from the east, the wise men from the east who were seeking the one who was born as the king of the Jews. And Matthew's the only one that tells of that account. Focusing in on showing that Jesus was the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. He was born to be a king. He was the Messiah. He was the promised one from the Old Testament scriptures. And Matthew emphasizes that in a remarkable way. Now, as you come on back to Mark's account, the Gospel of Mark has traditionally been taken as Peter's account. Mark was Peter's companion, was directly associated with him. When you go back, for instance, in the the books of Peter, in 1 Peter, 1 Peter 5 and verse 13, the church that is at Babylon, elected together with you, salutes you, and so does Mark, my son. Peter was very close to Mark, and refers to him in that way. Now, Peter had his headquarters in the latter part of his ministry. Because remember, Peter virtually disappears from Jerusalem in Acts 15. And you don't read about Peter to speak of after then, virtually nothing. Peter went elsewhere. James remained in Jerusalem, presiding over the headquarters church. Peter was in different places. He evidently spent some time in the British Isles, where, of course, many Israelites had gone. He also spent a lot of time in the east, in the Parthian Empire. Babylon was the capital, or was the major city there of the east in the Parthian Empire. The Parthian Empire was had a very large population of Israelites. Many of the descendants of the ten tribes were at that point of time in Parthia. Josephus even refers to that. And in addition, there was a very large Jewish community centered in Babylon and in the area of the Parthian Empire. So there were both Jews and Israelites in the Parthian Empire, very large numbers. And that Peter was, of course, the leader of the 12, and their primary area of responsibility was in going to the tribes of Israel. And Mark had evidently been Peter's companion and disciple for a number of years. Mark was related, was evidently a nephew to Barnabas. There's a reference in Colossians, several references, but in Colossians chapter 4, verse 10, Aristarchus, Colossians 4:10, Paul writes, "Aristarchus, my fellow prisoner, salutes you, and Marcus, sister's son to Barnabas, touching whom you receive commandments, if he come unto you, receive him." Mark was the son of Barnabas' sister. Barnabas' sister was named Mary, and she owned a home in Jerusalem, was evidently somewhat well-to-do, not necessarily wealthy, but certainly, I guess you would have to say, upper middle class anyway, because she owned a home that was large enough for the church to meet in, or at least a large group to get together in. She had a fairly sizable home. That's mentioned in Acts chapter 12. Acts 12:12. Peter went there to this home. Acts 12:12. When he had considered the thing, he came to the house of Mary, the mother of John, whose surname was Mark, where many were gathered together praying. And Peter knocked at the door of the gate, and a damsel came to hearken, named Rhoda, a little servant girl. And so there was evidently a considerable number of people. Peter knew that. It was a familiar gathering area. So Mary, the mother of Mark and the sister of Barnabas, owned this home. There's no mention of her husband, so it's referred to as her home. So we would conclude that her husband was probably dead. She was a widow. That has led to some speculation as to even whether or not that home was the place where the Christ's final Passover was. You know, Mark is the only one who tells the story. He records it in Mark 14. Let's just notice here. Mark 14, 51. Or verse 50, Mark 14:50, tells about Christ being betrayed and being arrested. And when he was arrested, we're told in Mark 14:50, they all forsook him and fled. And there followed him a certain young man, having a linen cloth cast about his naked body. And the young men laid hold on him, and he left the linen cloth and fled from them naked. Now, evidently, this young man wrapped in the cloth, the impression is that
that might have been Mark himself. You know, how was he aware of the details? He left the name out. If I'd been him, I'd have left the name out too. But it's one of the reasons that has one of the things that led to speculation that the Passover supper may have actually been there in that home, because the indication is, you know, that he had gone to bed and he heard something, you know, heard the men leaving or knew something was going on, got up, wrapped this sort of a sheet around him, and went sneaking off after them. And he was hiding there in the bushes, you know, wanting to see what all was going on. And when everybody fled and all the commotion was going on, somebody looked over and saw him, and they grabbed for him. And when they did, well, they got a hold of the sheet, and Mark left the sheet and took off. So whether or not, I don't know that that conclusively proves that he was there in the same house where they had the final Passover meal or not, but very possibly so. There was some reason why this young fellow, a young teenager, evidently, is the term that's used here, the term young man, the Greek term, is a term that refers to adolescence, not a little child, not a full adult, but more of an adolescent. There was some reason why this adolescent boy had known where they were and sort of sneaked off following them, wanted to be out there to see where, you know, what all was happening. There was evidently a certain amount of excitement and tension in the air, and he wanted to see what was going on, which is not unusual for, you know, a kid wants to be where the action is and see what's going on. And he liked to have gotten caught, which, again, sometimes happens. One of those little funny incidents, you know, that is recorded there. And when you record that sort of detail, and nobody else mentions it, at least we know the age would have been about right, and sort of makes you wonder if that wasn't something about Mark himself. Mark was probably written from the area where Peter, in the eastern dispersion of the Jews in the area of Parthia, Mark was probably written from this area, maybe in the late 50s, somewhere up around 60 AD. Mark does not really focus on the birth of Christ. He picks up the story. Mark 1:1, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. As it is written in the prophets, behold, I send my messenger before your face, which shall prepare your way before you. So he starts up with the account that is mentioned in Malachi and goes forward through the account of John the Baptist and comes down through the account of Christ's life. And the narrative in Mark's narrative abounds with all sorts of details in terms of time and place and circumstances. The feelings and the manner of Jesus and others are mentioned. Greek scholars make the statement about Mark's gospel that the language is the, quote, clean, vigorous, direct speech of the sturdy middle class. The style is very simple. The stately periods of the classics are wholly absent. It's terse and concise. The descriptions are very vivid. It focuses on Christ as the servant of the Lord. Matthew focuses in on his role as son of David. In Isaiah chapters 40 through 53, there's much that is said about the servant. And Mark is certainly a gospel of deeds. It talks about there's a word that is rendered straightway or immediately. Mark uses it 41 times, five times as much as the other gospel writers put together. He focuses on what Jesus did over and over. And Mark's gospel is in chronological order. He goes through and tells the story in that way. It would traditionally be
the gospel that was written to initially serve in the areas where Peter was primarily teaching. And it represented the story from Peter's perspective. And there are details that are added in that that are there. And Mark adds in certain of those stories. Luke, just as Mark was the gospel account that corresponded to Peter's preaching and was written primarily to serve in the area, or initially to serve in the areas where Peter was, Luke's account is, Luke was Paul's traveling companion. He was the one that went with Paul here, there, and everywhere. And it was written as an account primarily to, or initially to serve in the areas where Paul preached and raised up churches. Luke was a, it was written for circulation in the Greek-speaking Gentile world. Luke was most likely a highly educated Greek, probably from Antioch. He was a physician. His account is written in the classical historical style of the day. Now, Luke was actually written as a, was initially a two-volume work, Luke 1:1. For as much as many have taken in hand to set forth in order a declaration of those things which are most surely believed among us, even as they delivered them unto us from the beginning, which from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word. It seemed good to me also, having had perfect understanding of all things from the very first, or having had complete understanding of all things in order, that's the sense of it, to write unto you in order, most excellent Theophilus, that you might know the certainty of those things wherein you have been instructed. Now it's addressed here to Theophilus. If you go back to the book of Acts chapter 1, in Acts chapter 1, verse 1, the former treatise which I have made, O Theophilus, addressed to the same individual, of all that Jesus began both to do and to teach, until the day in which he was taken up, after that he, through the Holy Spirit, had given commandments unto the apostles whom he had chosen. And so he starts up the story, see, with the ascension of Christ, and comes on then up to the time of Paul's first Roman imprisonment. Luke wrote this. He was Paul's traveling companion. They traveled throughout the Greek world, the Gentile world. And so Luke was writing this to correspond, to go into and give background to things that in the areas where Paul had preached. Now, Luke writes as a historian. This book was intended for the public, especially for the Greek public, from the beginning. And just as Matthew goes back and continually refers to the Old Testament and focuses the attention of his readers on what was said in the Hebrew Scriptures and how this is the fulfillment. In other words, Matthew writes using the Old Testament to prove and buttress the points that he makes. Luke appeals quite a bit to the details of secular history. Luke 1, verse 5. There was in the days of Herod, the king of Judea, a certain priest named Zacharias, of the course of Abijah, and his wife was of the daughters of Aaron, and her name was Elizabeth. And they were both righteous before God. Now, as he comes on down, he gives this detailed story about the birth, chapter 2, verse 1. It came to pass in those days that there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be taxed. And this taxing was first made when Cyrenius was governor of Syria. And so he goes through and he describes that. Chapter 3, verse 1. Now in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, Pontius Pilate being governor of Judea, Herod being tetrarch of Galilee, his brother Philip, tetrarch of Eritrea, and of the region of Trachonitis and Licinius, the Tetrarch of Abilene, Annas and Caiaphas being the high priests. The word of God came unto John, the son of Zacharias, in the wilderness. So, you know, Luke nails down some of these things with reference to a secular historical event, reigns of governors, various things. He writes as a historian, giving you information to date and to cross-correlate some of these events. And gives those sort of details in a way that that none of the other Gospels do. Luke stresses the humanity of Christ, that he was the Son of Man. Matthew stresses that he was the Son of David. Mark emphasizes that he was the servant of God. Luke emphasizes that he was the Son of Man as well as the Son of David. Luke is the only one who records the statement in Luke that's recorded in Luke chapter 2 and verse 10. The angel said unto them, so this is speaking to the shepherds, the angel said unto them, "Fear not, behold, I bring you good tidings of great joy, which shall be to all people." Now, none of the other gospel accounts emphasize that this good tidings of great joy, the gospel message, was for all people. You see, Luke emphasizes that this was what was said from the beginning. His gospel was primarily circulating in the Gentile areas, and he emphasized that from the beginning, this message was intended for everyone. Luke is the only one that tells the story of the shepherds. And he goes into that. Luke goes through and has quite a bit of detail in this regard. It may very well have been written during the time of Paul's imprisonment in Caesarea before he went to Rome. There was certainly have been time at that point for Paul to have collaborated with Luke in terms of putting together this gospel, and Luke spent time with Paul. He would have been in a position to interview different ones, and Luke wrote very much as a historian. The genealogy, as Luke traces it, he emphasizes something different than Matthew. Matthew started with Abraham, you know, Jesus Christ, the son of Abraham, the son of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Now, Luke, on the other hand, focuses differently. Luke chapter 3, verse 23, Jesus himself began to be about 30 years of age, being, as was supposed, the son of Joseph, which was of Heli. If you'll notice, the words "the son" are in italics. It shows here the shows relationship. Luke's account of the genealogy was evidently the genealogy of Mary, and Jesus being, as was supposed, the son of Joseph, who was, of course, the son-in-law of Heli. And he traces the genealogy back, not simply to David or to Abraham, but he traces it all the way back down here. Notice in chapter 3, verse 38, which was the son of Enos, which was the son of Seth, which was the son of Adam, which was the son of God. So he traces it all the way back. Where did Jesus come from? Well, he was the promised seed, the seed that was promised to Adam and Eve in the garden. He traces back, you see, that he's the Savior of all mankind. And not that the others by any means denied that, but that that is an emphasis in the book of Luke, that you emphasize certain things based on the audience to which you're writing. Luke is the only one who quotes the statement in Luke chapter 3, verse 6. He's quoting Isaiah 40, verse 5, all flesh shall see the salvation of God. All flesh. That, again, is something that is emphasized by Luke because he's writing to an audience that is primarily Gentile. So Matthew, Mark, and Luke wrote all prior to 70 AD, prior Peter put together the original canon of the New Testament, the first 22 out of the 27 New Testament books. The initial gospel accounts were Matthew, Mark, and Luke, each written by a different personality from a different vantage point, written to a different audience, so they stress different things. And when you put the accounts together, you get more details. Each one is telling it with a different emphasis because if you're writing to a different audience, you tend to stress different things. And this was the state of things from, let's say, the 60s AD for about 30 years. But in the 30 years that transpired between the writing of the first three Gospels and the book of John, a great deal had occurred. The Jewish revolt and the destruction followed by the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, had a massive impact. It caused the Jerusalem church to have to flee. Also, by the time of 70 AD, most of the first generation of Christians were either dead or very elderly. Because you just figure anybody who was, let's say, the age of Jesus would have been in their 70s by that time. Most of the apostles, virtually all of them, with the exception of John, had been martyred. You figure that in the account of the day of Pentecost there in Acts 2, in 31 A.D., that anyone who was, in their 30s would have been in their 70s now by the time of Jerusalem's destruction. So you have a passing from the scene of the first generation. You have the destruction of Jerusalem, the scattering of the Jewish community. You have Rome clamping down the lid in Judea. The Jerusalem church has had to flee into an area, sort of a remote area, to hide, to be sort of away from all of the strife and the fighting. And over the course then of the last half, the last third anyway, or the last quarter of the first century, there is an increase of heresies. We know that there were problems already. Paul talked about in 1 Thessalonians written in the 50s, he talked about that the mystery of iniquity was already at work. Well, by the time Paul and Peter and the others had passed from the scene, the mystery of iniquity was really at work. And a lot of false doctrine was beginning to be promulgated, and most of those who were eyewitnesses were no longer around. And new problems and new issues arose. By the 90s AD, John was one of the only ones left of that first generation. He was certainly the only one who had intimately known Christ that was left alive. And so John wrote the Gospel of John. Any commentator readily notes that John is very different from Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Well, Matthew, Mark, and Luke had told the story from the beginning, sort of working their way through. John didn't need to go back and do that. John purposely wrote to tell the story from a different perspective because John was writing at a different time. He was writing 30, 35 years after the others. So he was writing to address issues and problems that hadn't even occurred earlier, but were now increasingly an issue. John was in Asia Minor at this time and wound up, of course, for a while exiled on the Isle of Patmos off the coast of Asia Minor. Ephesus evidently seems to have served as his headquarters at the toward the end of his life. John wrote five books, which he added to the 22 that Peter had put together, the Gospel of John, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, and the book of Revelation. And so John deals with and addresses things that the others had not. The The Gnostic heresies set in motion by Simon Magus were sweeping the church at that time. John emphasizes the divine nature of Jesus Christ and the fact that Jesus Christ was the Son of God who came in the flesh. You know, if Matthew emphasizes he was the son of David, and Mark emphasizes that he was the servant of the Lord, and Luke emphasizes that he was the Son of Man, John emphasizes that he was the Son of God. He was God in the flesh. He was Emmanuel, God with us. He was the Word. The Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. And John emphasizes the divine nature of Jesus Christ, that he came as a human being and was God in the flesh. And he also emphasizes certain teachings of Christ, particularly in relationship to the holy days. You know, John emphasizes throughout the Gospel of John that Jesus kept the feasts that the Jews kept. You know, it was a time of great, of increasing anti-Jewish stir in the Roman Empire as a result of the Jewish revolt. And the Romans were cracking down and were bringing in oppressive and discriminatory things aimed at the Jews. There was a tendency among some to try to distance. This was part of the original excuse, you see, to abandon the law, was that we ought to put a distance between ourselves and the Jews. These things aren't necessary, and it's just identifying us with the Jews and bringing unnecessary persecution. This is, you know, sort of the logic of the Joe Jr. of the day. John emphasized over and over, he's the only one who uses the expression of the Feast of the Jews. Feast of the Jews. Jesus went up to Jerusalem, to the Jews' Feast of Tabernacles. You know, he emphasized over and over that Jesus was going up and was participating in, was keeping the festivals that the Jews kept. That's the John 7:2. You know, the Jews' Feast of Tabernacles was at hand. If you come back, John 6:4, the Passover, a feast of the Jews, was near. John 5:1, after this was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. This expression is used, John 2:13. The Jews' Passover was at hand. Jesus went up to Jerusalem. John emphasizes over and over this connection. John, nearly the entire Gospel of John, is centered around what Christ did and said at various festival seasons. You know, you have the introduction in John chapter 1, and in John chapter 2, the Jews' Passover was at hand. Jesus went up to Jerusalem. And so John, the rest of John 2 and 3 has to do with the first Passover of Jesus' ministry and his teaching and what he was saying at that time. And, you know, chapter 4 is the account of the woman at the well in Samaria, which evidently was right at Pentecost time. The subject matter would lead us to say that, but the statement where Jesus told the disciples, "You say," John 4:35, "You say there are yet 4 months and then comes harvest. I say unto you, lift up your eyes, look at the fields, they're white already to harvest." Well, you know, the beginning of the third month would be right before Pentecost. The beginning of the seventh month would be right at the time of the culmination of the Feast of Ingathering, the time of celebrated the Great Harvest. So we would say that John 4 was written 4 months. The account in John 4 occurred 4 months prior to the time of the Great Fall Harvest. So that would put it at the time of Pentecost and just prior to Pentecost. And, of course, what did Christ talk about? Well, he talked about worshiping God in spirit, and he talked about God's spirit and being like rivers of living water. I mean, the subject matter ties in with that. John 5, Feast of the Jews, and it goes through... doesn't specify which feast. I think the subject matter would lend itself to one of the fall festivals. It is a time of here where he talked about judgment, you know, the Father raising the dead, John 5:21, quickens whom he will. Father judges no man, has committed all judgment to the Son. That would certainly, the message, the content would tie in with fall festivals. John 6 identifies itself as the Passover season. And if you've been keeping up, this is, number 4, as we go through here. If you come on over to John 7, the Jews' Feast of Tabernacles was at hand, John 7, verse 2. So now we come into the Feast of Tabernacles, and then John 7:37, the last day, the great day of the feast. Well, the last great day is a separate festival. You know, that's number 6. And you, if you follow the account carefully, you go all the way through the end of chapter 7 through chapter 8, 9, and 10. And those... That most of that has to do with events that occurred on the last great day. And then in chapter 11, verse 55, the Jews' Passover was near at hand. That's Christ's final Passover. If you've been counting, that's number 7. There's 7 festival seasons to which John makes reference. And probably 90% of the whole content of the book of John centers around what Jesus said and did and taught in conjunction with these festival seasons. Now this is 60 years after everything that was done away and nailed to the cross had been done away and nailed to the cross. If all this was done away, why did John keep talking? Why did he spend so much time talking about what Jesus said and did and taught in relationship to the holy days? Now, beginning in John 12, on to the end of the book, the focus is on the last Passover of Christ's life. John is the only one who records most of what Jesus said that evening. He doesn't go back through all the details of what they did. Matthew, Mark, and Luke all tell about the bread and the wine and everything. But John talks about what they didn't talk about. He talks about foot washing. He talks about what Jesus said. And... So it, there is an emphasis on that sort of thing. John focuses in on the material that the church needed 60 years after the establishment of the church, when new things had been, or new issues had risen. God allowed one of the apostles to live much longer, so that as the first generation had passed from the scene, many of these problems came to prominence, that John then was in a position to respond to them, to deal with those issues, and to provide a written record for us that sort of puts the capstone. So when you put all 4 Gospels together, you get a very complete picture. And that's what we're going to start into next time. I have study questions that I'll pass out to you, and we will get into that. It'll the questions themselves will direct you in terms of what parts of what Gospels sort of connect. So anyway, we'll see you next time.